Chapter 13. Further south, the snow and ice became impermanent, though it was still cold by non-Nilt standards. Nilters regarded the equatorial region as a sort of tropical paradise, where grain can actually grow, where the temperature can easily exceed 8 or 9 degrees Celsius. Most of Nilt's large cities are on or near the equatorial ring. The same is true of the planet's one claim to any sort of fame, the glass bridges. These are approximately 5-meter-wide ribbons of black, hanging in gentle catenaries across trenches nearly as wide as they are deep, dimensions measured in kilometers. No cables, no piers, no trusses, just the arc of black attached to each cliff face. Fantastic arrangements of colored glass coils and rods hang from the bottoms of the bridges, sometimes projecting sideways. The bridges themselves are, according to all observations, also made of glass, though glass could never possibly withstand the sort of stress these bridges do. Even their own weight should be too much for them, suspended as they are with nothing for support. There are no rails or handholds, just the drop, and at the bottom, kilometers down, a cluster of thick-walled tubes, each one just 1.5 meters wide, empty and smooth-walled. These are made of the same material as the bridges. No one knows what the bridges and the tubes beneath them were for, or who built them. They were here when humans first colonized Nilt. Theories abound, each one less likely than the one before. Interdimensional beings feature prominently in many of them. These either created or shaped humanity for its own purposes, or left a message for humans to decipher for obscure reasons of their own, or they were evil, bent on destruction of all life. The bridges were somehow part of their plan. Another whole subfield claims the bridges were built by humans, some ancient, long-lost, fantastically advanced civilization that either died out, slowly, pathetically, or spectacularly as the result of some catastrophic mistake, or moved on to a higher level of existence. Advocates of this sort of theory often make the additional claim that Nilt is, in reality, the birthplace of humans. Nearly everywhere I've been, popular wisdom has it that the location of humanity's original planet is unknown, mysterious. In fact, it isn't, as anyone who troubles to read on the subject will discover, but it is very, very, very far away from nearly anywhere, and not a tremendously interesting place. Or at the very least, not nearly as interesting as the enchanting idea that your people are not newcomers to their homes, but in fact only recolonized the place they had belonged from the beginning of time. One meets this claim anywhere one finds a remotely human habitable planet. The bridge outside Terod wasn't much of a tourist attraction. Most of the jewel-bright arabesques of glass had shattered over thousands of years, leaving it nearly plain, and Terod is still too far north for non-Nilters to endure comfortably. Off-world visitors generally confine themselves to the better-preserved bridges on the equator. By a bove-hair blanket guaranteed hand-spun and hand-woven by masters of the craft in the unbearably cold reaches of the world, though these are almost certainly turned out on machines by the dozen a few kilometres from the gift shop, choke down a few fetid swallows of fermented milk, and return home to regale their friends and associates with tales of their adventure. All this I learned within a few minutes of knowing I would need to visit Nilt to achieve my aim. Terod sat on a broad river, chunks of green and white ice bobbing and crashing in its current. The first boats of the season already moored at the docks. On the opposite side of the city, the dark slash of the bridge's huge trough made a definitive stop to the straggling edge of houses. The southern edge of the city was flyer parks, then a wide complex of blue and yellow painted buildings that was, by the look of it, a medical facility, one that must have been the largest of its kind in the area. It was surrounded by squares of lodgings and food shops and swathes of houses, bright pink, orange, yellow, red, in stripes and zigzags and crosshatches. We had flown half the day. I might have flown all night. I was capable of it, though it would have been unpleasant. But I saw no need for haste. I sat down in the first empty space I found, told Syverd and Kirtley to get out, and did so myself. I shouldered my pack, paid the parking fee, disabled the flyer as I had at Strigan's, and set off toward the city, not looking to see if Syverdon followed. I had sat down near the medical facility. The lodgings surrounding it were some of them luxurious, but many were smaller and less comfortable than the one I'd rented in the village where I'd found Cyverdon, though a bit more expensive. Bright-coated southerners came and went, speaking a language I didn't understand. Others spoke the one I knew, and fortunately this was the same language the signs used. I chose lodging, roomier at least than the suspension pod-size holes that were the cheapest available, and took Cyverdon off to the first clean-looking and moderately priced food shop I could find. When we entered, Cyverdon eyed the shelves of bottles on the far wall. "They have arrak." "It'll be incredibly expensive," I said, "and probably not very good. They don't make it here. Have a beer instead." She had been showing some signs of stress, and wincing slightly at the profusion of bright colours, so I expected some sort of irritable outburst, but instead she merely gestured acquiescence. Then she wrinkled her nose, slight disgust. "What do they make beer out of here?"
"Grain. It grows nearer the equator. It's not as cold there."
We found seats on the benches that lined three rows of long tables, and a waiter brought us beer and bowls of something she told us was the house speciality.
"Extra beautiful eating, yes?" she said, in a badly mangled approximation of ratchai,
and it was in fact quite good, and turned out to have actual vegetables in it, a good proportion of thinly sliced cabbage among whatever the rest of it was. The smaller lumps appeared to be meat, probably bove. Cyverdon cut one of the larger lumps in two with her spoon, revealing plain white.
"Probably cheese," I said.
She grimaced.
"Why can't these people eat real food? Don't they know better?"
"Cheese is real food. So is cabbage."
"But this sauce..."
"Tastes good."
I took another spoonful.
"This whole place smells funny,"
she complained.
"Just eat."
She looked dubiously at her bowl, scooped a spoonful, sniffed it.
"It can't possibly smell worse than that fermented milk drink," I said.
She actually half smiled.
"No."
I took another spoonful, pondering the implications of this better behaviour. I wasn't sure what it meant, about her state of mind, about her intentions, about who or what she thought I was. Maybe Strugan had been right, and Cyverdon had decided the most profitable course for now was to not alienate the person who was feeding her, and that would change as soon as her options changed. A high voice called out from another table.
"Hello?"
I turned. The girl with the tick-tick set waved to me from where she sat with her mother. For an instant I was surprised, but we were near the medical centre, where I knew they had brought their injured relative, and they had come from the same direction we had, and so they had likely parked on the same side of town. I smiled and nodded, and she got up and came to where we were sitting.
"Your friend is better," she said brightly. "That's good. What are you eating?"
"I don't know," I admitted. "The waiter said it was the house speciality."
"Oh, that's very good. I had it yesterday. When did you get here? It's so hot, it's like summer already. I can't imagine what it's like further north."
Clearly she'd had time to recover her more usual spirits since the accident that had brought her to Strigan's house. Cyverdon, spoon in hand, watched her bemused. "We've been here an hour," I said. "We're only stopping for the night, on our way to the ribbon."
"We're here until Uncle's legs are better, which will probably be another week."
She frowned, counting days.
"A little longer. We're sleeping in our flyer, which is terribly uncomfortable, but Mama says the price for lodging here is outright theft."
She sat down on the end of the bench next to me.
"I've never been in space. What's it like?"
"It's very cold. Even you would find it cold." She thought that was funny, gave a little laugh. "And of course, there's no air and hardly any gravity, so everything just floats." She frowned at me, mock rebuke.
"You know what I mean."
I glanced over to where her mother sat, stolid, eating, unconcerned.
"It's really not very exciting."
The girl made a gesture of indifference.
"Oh, you like music. There's a singer at a place down the street tonight."
She used the word I had used mistakenly, not the one she had corrected me with, in Strigan's house.
"We didn't go to hear her last night because they charge. And besides, she's my cousin. Or she's in the next lineage over from mine, and she's my mother's cousin's daughter's aunt. That's close enough, anyway. I heard her at the last ingather. She's very good."
"I'll be sure to go.
Where is it? She gave me the name of the place, and then said she had to finish her supper. I watched her go back to her mother, who only looked up briefly and gave a curt nod, which I returned. The place the girl had named was only a few doors down, a long, low-ceilinged building, its back wall all shutters, open just now on a walled yard, where Nilta sat uncoated in the one-degree air, drinking beer, listening silently to a woman playing a bowed stringed instrument I'd never seen before. I quietly ordered beer for myself and Syverdon, and we took seats on the inner side of the shutters, slightly warmer than the yard for the lack of a breeze, and with a wall to put our backs against. A few people turned to look at us, stared a moment, then turned away more or less politely. Syverdon leaned 3 centimetres in my direction and whispered, "Why are we here?"
"To hear the music."
She raised an eyebrow.
"This is music."
I turned to look at her directly. She flinched, just slightly.
"Sorry, it's just..."
She gestured helplessly. "Ratcha, I do have stringed instruments. Quite a variety of them, in fact, accrued through several annexations. But playing them in public is considered a slightly risque act, because one has to play either bare-handed or in gloves so thin as to be nearly pointless. And this music, the long, slow, uneven phrases that made its rhythms difficult for the Ratcha'i ear to hear, the harsh, edged tone of the instrument, was not what Syverdon had been brought up to appreciate.
"It's so..."
A woman at a nearby table turned and made a reproving, shushing noise. I gestured conciliation, and turned a cautioning look on Syverdon. For a moment her anger showed in her face, and I was sure I would have to take her outside. But she took a breath, and looked at her beer, and drank, and afterward looked steadily ahead in silence. The piece ended and the audience rapped fists gently on their tables. The string player somehow looked both impassive and gratified, and launched into another, this one noticeably faster, and loud enough for Syverdon to safely whisper to me again,
"How long are we going to be here?"
"A while," I said.
"I'm tired. I want to go back to the room."
"Do you know where it is?" She gestured assent. The woman at the other table eyed us disapprovingly.
"Go,"
I whispered, as quietly as I could, and still I hoped to be heard by Syverdon. Syverdon left. "Not my concern anymore," I told myself. "Whether she found her way back to our lodgings," and I congratulated myself on having had the foresight to lock my pack in the facilities safe for the night, even without Strigan's warning, I didn't trust Syverdon with my belongings or my money, "or wandered aimlessly through the city, or walked into the river and drowned. Whatever she did, it was no concern of mine, and nothing I needed to worry about. I had, instead, a jar of sufficiently decent beer, and an evening of music, with the promise of a good singer, and songs I'd never heard before. I was nearer to my goal than I'd ever dared hope to be, and I could, for just this one night, relax. The singer was excellent, though I didn't understand any of the words she sang. She came on late, and by then the place was crowded and noisy, though the audience occasionally fell silent over their beer, listening to the music, and the knocking between pieces grew loud and boisterous. I ordered enough beer to justify my continued presence, but did not drink most of it. I'm not human, but my body is, and too much would have dulled my reactions unacceptably. I stayed quite late, and then walked back to our lodgings along the darkened street, here and there a pair or threesome walking, conversing, ignoring me. In the tiny room I found Syverdon asleep, motionless, breathing calm, face and limbs slack. Something indefinably still about her suggested that this was the first I'd seen her in real, restful sleep. For the briefest instant, I found myself wondering if she'd taken Kef, but I knew she had no money, didn't know anyone here, and didn't speak any of the languages I had heard so far. I lay down beside her and slept. I woke 6 hours later, and incredibly, Syverdon still lay beside me, still asleep. I didn't think she had waked while I slept. She might as well get as much rest as she could. I was, after all, in no hurry. I rose and went out. Further toward the medical center, the street became noisy and crowded. I bought a bowl of hot, milky porridge from a vendor along the side of the walkway and continued along where the road curved around the hospital and off toward the center of the town. Buses stopped, let passengers off, picked others up, continued on. In the stream of people, I saw someone I recognized. The girl from Strigan's and her mother. They saw me. The girl's eyes widened, and she frowned slightly. Her mother's expression didn't change, but they both swerved to approach me. They had, it seemed, been watching for me. "Breck," said the girl, when they had stopped in front of me, subdued, uncharacteristically, it seemed. "Is your uncle all right?" I asked.
"Yes, uncle is fine."
But clearly something troubled her.
"Your friend," said her mother, impassive as always, and stopped.
"Yes?" "Our flyer is parked near yours," the girl said,
clearly dreading the communication of bad news.
"We saw it when we got back from supper last night."
"Tell me." I didn't enjoy suspense. Her mother actually frowned.
"It's not there now."
I said nothing, waiting for the rest.
"You must have disabled it," she continued. "Your friend took money, and the people who paid him towed the flyer away."
The lot staff must not have questioned it. They had seen Syverdon with me.
"She doesn't speak any languages," I protested. "They made lots of motions," explained the girl, gesturing widely. "Lots of pointing and speaking very slow."
I had badly underestimated Syverdon. Of course. She had survived, going from place to place with no language but Radja'ai, and likely no money, but still had managed to nearly overdose on Kef, more than once likely. She could manage herself, even if she managed badly. She was entirely capable of getting what she wanted without help, and she had wanted Kef, and she had obtained it, at my expense. But that was of no importance to her.
"We knew it couldn't be right," said the girl, "because you said you were only stopping the night on the way to space. But no one would have listened to us. We're just both herders."
And no doubt the sort of person who would buy a flyer with no documentation, no proof of ownership, a flyer, moreover, that had obviously been deliberately disabled to prevent its being moved by anyone but the owner, it might very well be a good idea to avoid confronting such a person.
"I would not presume to say," said the girl's mother, a bleak condemnation, "what sort of friend your friend is."
"Not my friend. Never my friend now or at any other time." "Thank you for telling me." I walked to the lot, and the flyer was indeed gone. When I returned to the room, I found Syverdon still sleeping, or at any rate still unconscious. I wondered just how much Kef the flyer had bought her. I only wondered long enough to retrieve my pack from the lodging safe, pay for the night. After this, Syverdon would have to fend for herself, which apparently posed very little problem for her, and went looking for transport out of town. There was a bus, but the first had left 15 minutes before I asked after it, and the next would not leave for 3 hours. A train ran alongside the river, northward once a day, and like the bus, it had already left. I didn't want to wait. I wanted to be gone from here. More specifically, I didn't want to chance seeing Syverdon again, even briefly. The temperature here was mostly above freezing, and I was entirely capable of walking long distances. The next town worth the name was, according to maps I'd seen, only a day away, if I cut across the glass bridge and then straight across the countryside, instead of following the road, which curved to avoid the river and the bridge's wide chasm. The bridge was several kilometres out of town. The walk would do me good. I had not had enough exercise lately. The bridge itself might be mildly interesting. I set off toward it. When I had walked a little over half a kilometre, past the lodgings and food shops that surrounded the medical centre, into what looked like a residential neighbourhood, smaller buildings, groceries, clothes shops, complexes of low square houses joined by covered passageways, Syverdon came up behind me.
"Breck,"
she gasped, out of breath.
"Where are you going?"
I didn't answer, only walked faster.
"Breck! Damn it!"
I stopped, but did not turn around. Considered speaking. Nothing I thought of saying was remotely temperate, nor would anything I said do any sort of good. Syverdon caught up with me.
"Why didn't you wake me up?"
she asked. Answers occurred to me. I refrained from speaking any of them aloud, and instead began walking again. I didn't look back. I didn't care if she followed me or not. Hoped, in fact, she wouldn't. I could certainly have no continued sense of responsibility, no fears that without me she would be helpless. She could take care of herself.
Breck! Damn it!
Cyverdon called again, and then swore, and I heard her footsteps behind me, and her laboured breath again as she caught up. This time I didn't stop, but quickened my pace slightly. After another 5 kilometres, during which she had intermittently fallen behind, and then raced, gasping to catch up, she said,
"Archer's tits! You hold a grudge, don't you?"
Still I said nothing, and didn't stop. Another hour passed, the town well behind us, and the bridge came in sight. Flat black, arcing across the drop, spikes and curls of glass below, brilliant red, intense yellow, ultramarine, and jagged stubs of others. The chasm walls were striated, black, green-grey and blue, frosted here and there with ice. Below, the bottom of the chasm was lost in cloud. A sign in 5 languages proclaimed it to be a protected monument, access permitted only to a certain class of license holders. What license, to what purpose, was mysterious to me, as I did not recognize all the words on the sign. A low barrier blocked the entrance, nothing I could not easily step over, and there was no one here but me and Cyverdon. The bridge itself was 5 meters wide, like all the others, and while the wind blew strong, it wasn't strong enough to endanger me. I strode forward and stepped over the barrier and out onto the bridge. Had heights troubled me, I might have found it dizzying. Fortunately, they did not, and my only discomfort was the feeling of open spaces behind and under me that I could not see unless I turned my attention away from other places. My boots thunked on the black glass, and the whole structure swayed slightly and shuddered in the wind. A new pattern of vibrations told me Cyverdon had followed me. What happened next was largely my own fault. We were halfway across when Cyverdon spoke.
All right, I get it. You're angry.
I stopped, but did not turn. How much did it get you? I asked finally, only one of the things I had considered saying.
What?
Though I hadn't turned, I could see the motion as she leaned over, hands on her knees, could hear her still breathing hard, straining to be heard against the wind. How much, Kef?
I only wanted a little,
she said, not quite answering my question.
Enough to take the edge off. I need it, and it's not like you paid for that flyer to begin with.
For an instant, I thought she had remembered how I had acquired the flyer, unlikely as that seemed. But she continued,
"You've got enough of that pack to buy 10 flyers, and none of it's yours. It belongs to the Lord of the Ratch, doesn't it? Making me walk like this is just you being pissy."
I stood, still facing forward, my coat flattened against me in the wind, stood, trying to understand what her words meant, about who or what she thought I was, why she thought I had troubled myself about her.
"I know what you are,"
she said, as I stood silent.
"No doubt you wish you could leave me behind, but you can't, can you? You got orders to bring me back."
"What am I?" I asked, still without turning, loud against the wind.
"Nobody. That's who."
Cyverdon's voice was scornful. She was standing upright now, just behind my left shoulder.
"You tested into military, in the aptitudes, and like a million other nobodies these days, you think that makes you somebody. And you practiced the accent and how to hold your utensils, and knelt your way to special missions, and now I'm your special mission. You've got to bring me home in one piece, even though you'd rather not, wouldn't you? You've got a problem with me, and I guess your problem is that try all you like, whoever you kneel to, you'll never be what I was born to be. And people like you hate that."
I turned toward her. I'm certain my face was without expression, but when my eyes met hers, she flinched. No edge taken off, none at all, and took 3 quick, reflexive steps backward, over the edge of the bridge. I stepped to the edge, looked down. Cyverdon hung 6 meters below, hands clenched around a complicated swirl of red glass, her eyes wide, mouth open slightly. She looked up at me and said,
"You were going to hit me."
The calculations came easily to me. All my clothes knotted would only reach 5.7 meters. The red glass was connected somewhere under the bridge I couldn't see. No sign of anything she could climb. The coloured glass wasn't as strong as the bridge itself. I guessed the red spiral would shatter under Cyverdon's weight sometime in the next 3 to 7 seconds, though that was only a guess. Still, any help I might call would certainly arrive too late. Cloud still veiled the bottom reaches of the chasm. Those tubes were just a few centimeters narrower than my outstretched arms and were themselves very deep.
"Breck!" Cyverdon's voice was breathy and strained. "Can you do something?"
"Not at least. You have to do something."
"Do you trust me?" I asked. Her eyes widened further. Her gasp became a bit more ragged.
She didn't trust me, I knew. She was only still with me because she thought I was official, hence inescapable, and she was important enough for the Ratch to send someone after her. Underestimating her own importance was never one of Cyverdon's failings, and perhaps because she was tired of running, from the world, from herself, ready to give up. But I still didn't understand why I was with her. Of all the officers I've served with, she was never one of my favorites.
"I trust you,"
she lied.
"When I grab you, raise your armor and put your arms around me."
Fresh alarm flashed across her face, because there was no more time. I extended my armor under my clothes and stepped off the bridge. The instant my hands touched her shoulders, the red glass shattered, sharp-edged fragments flying out and away, glittering briefly. Cyverdon closed her eyes, ducked her head, face into my neck, held me tight enough that if I hadn't been armored, my breathing would have been impeded. Because of the armor, I couldn't feel her panicked breath on my skin, couldn't feel the air rushing past, though I could hear it. But she didn't extend her own armor. If I had been more than just myself, if I had had the numbers I needed, I could have calculated our terminal velocity and just how long it would take to reach it. Gravity was easy, but the drag of my pack and our heavy coats whipping up around us, affecting our speed, was beyond me. It would have been much easier to calculate in a vacuum, but we weren't falling in a vacuum. But the difference between 50 meters a second and 150 was, at the moment, only large in the abstract. I couldn't see the bottom yet. The target I was hoping to hit was small, and I didn't know how much time we'd have to adjust our attitude, if we even could. For the next 20 to 40 seconds, we had nothing to do but wait and fall.
"Armor!"
I shouted into Cyverdon's ear.
"Sold it,"
she answered. Her voice shook slightly, straining against the rushing air. Her face was still pressed hard against my neck. Suddenly, grey. Moisture formed on exposed portions of my armor and blew streaming upward. 1.35 seconds later, I saw the ground, dark circles packed tight, bigger and therefore closer than I liked. A surge of adrenaline surprised me. I must have gotten too used to falling. I turned my head, trying to look straight down past Cyverdon's shoulder to what lay directly below us. My armor was made to spread out the force of a bullet's impact, bleed some of it away as heat. It was theoretically impenetrable, but I could still be injured or even killed with the application of sufficient force. I'd suffered broken bones, lost bodies under an unrelenting hail of bullets. I wasn't sure what the friction of decelerating would do to my armor or to me. I had some skeletal and muscular augmentation, but whether it would be sufficient for this, I had no idea. I was unable to calculate just exactly how fast we were going, just exactly how much energy needed to be bled away to slow to a survivable speed, how hot it would get inside and outside my armor. And unarmored, Cyverdon wouldn't be able to assist. Of course, if I had still been what I once was, it wouldn't matter. This wouldn't have been my only body. I couldn't help thinking I should have let Cyverdon fall, shouldn't have jumped. Falling, I still didn't know why I had done it, but at the moment of choice, I had found I couldn't walk away. By then I knew our distance in centimeters.
5 seconds, I said,
shouted above the wind. By then it was 4.
If we were very, very lucky, we'd fall straight into the tube below us, and I'd push my hands and feet against the walls.
If we were very, very lucky, the heat from the friction wouldn't burn unarmored Cyverdon too badly. If I was even luckier, I'd only break my wrists and ankles. All of it struck me as unlikely, but the omens would fall as Amaat intended. Falling didn't bother me. I could fall forever and not be hurt. It's stopping that's the problem. 3 seconds, I said.
Breck,
Cyverdon said, a gasping sob.
Please.
Some answers I would never have. I abandoned what calculations I was still making. I didn't know why I had jumped, but at that moment it no longer mattered. At that moment, there was nothing else.
Whatever you do.
1 second.
Don't let go.
Darkness. No impact. I thrust out my arms, which were immediately forced upwards, wrists and one ankle breaking on impact despite my armor's reinforcement, tendons and muscles tearing, and we began to tumble sideways. Despite the pain, I pulled my arms and legs in and reached and kicked out again, quickly, steadying us the instant after. Something in my right leg broke as I did, but I couldn't afford to worry about it. Centimeter by centimeter, we slowed. I could no longer control my hands or feet, could only push against the walls and hope we wouldn't be pushed off balance again and fall, helpless, head first to our deaths. The pain was sharp, blinding, blocking out everything except numbers. A distance, estimated. Decreasing by centimeters, also estimated. Speed, estimated. Decreasing. External armor temperature, increasing at my extremities. Possible danger of exceeding acceptable parameters. Possible resulting injury. But the numbers were near meaningless to me. The pain was louder, more immediate than anything else. But the numbers were important. A comparison of distance and our rate of deceleration suggested disaster ahead. I tried to take a deep breath, found I was incapable of it, and tried to push harder against the walls. I have no memory of the rest of the descent. I woke, on my back, in pain. My hands and arms, my shoulders, feet and legs. In front of me, directly above, a circle of grey light. Cyverdon, I tried to say, but it came out as a convulsive sigh that echoed just slightly against the walls.
Cyverdon.
The name came out this time, but barely audible, and distorted by my armor. I dropped the armor and tried speaking again, managing this time to engage my voice. Cyverdon. I raised my head, just slightly. In the dim light from above, I saw that I lay on the ground, knees bent, and turned to one side, the right leg at a disturbing angle, my arms straight beside my body. I tried to move a finger. Failed. A hand. Failed, of course. I tried shifting my right leg, which responded with more pain. There was no one here but me. Nothing here but me. I didn't see my pack. At one time, if there had been a Ratcha'ai ship in orbit, I could have contacted it, easy as thought. But if I had been anywhere a Ratcha'ai ship was likely to be, this would never have happened. If I had left Cyverdon in the snow, this would never have happened. I had been so close. After 20 years of planning and working, of maneuvering, 2 steps forward here, a step backward there, slowly, patiently, against all likelihood, I had gotten this far. So many times I had made a throw like this, not only my success at hazard, but my life, and each time I had won, or at least not lost in any way that prevented me from trying again. Until now. And for such a stupid reason. Above me, clouds hid the unreachable sky, the future I no longer had, the goal I was now incapable of accomplishing. Failed. I closed my eyes against tears not brought on by physical pain. If I failed, it would not be because I had ever, at any time, given up. Cyverdon had left somehow. I would find her. I would rest a moment, recollect myself, find the strength to pull out the handheld I kept in my coat, and call for help, or discover some other way to leave here. And if it meant I dragged myself out on the bloody, useless remains of my limbs, I would do that, pain or no pain, or I would die trying.